This is CliffCentral.com.
It was late July 2009. My friend Rafiq and I were gearing up for the busy season. As a researcher, writer, and media voice, this period of the year is what's termed developmental season, or put more simply, silly season. At the time, Rafiq was living in South Africa. He's now back home in the Bahamas, but he was also entering a peak period for the year himself. Rafiq has a much more complicated history than me. As an American, I've always found his history fascinating. He spent his life between the Bahamas, Canada, Ghana, and New York, with a decade of his career in South Africa, before diving headfirst into 2009 silly season. Rafiq and I ventured out onto the town. You know, and I rarely went out, but since we were both single, why not? We found ourselves at a restaurant sitting outside around 6:30 p.m. Weather was perfect. Adjacent to us was two lovely Indian ladies. We both had a glass of wine, and they were drinking cocktails. We didn't exist in their minds. They never looked our way. We weren't surprised because we both had been living in South Africa for 5 years or more. We understood the majority of South Africans stick with and date their own races. But more importantly, socially speaking, people from other races are often seen as non-people. Or they just don't factor. Not so much that they don't care, they just don't factor. So while we both found them attractive, we continued to laugh and enjoy our night until something unexpected happened. Welcome back to the next episode of the Brain and Brand podcast. I'm Timothy Maurice, and this is the show exploring the link between human and brand behavior, how people impact brands and how brands and stories impact people. Thanks so much for subscribing and following the growth and evolution of this show. I'm having a blast, and I'm extremely grateful for the opportunity to share this research and insight into how people and brands behave. This episode will explore how perceived taste in each other impacts how we treat and relate to each other. I'm going to argue that how we see each other determines how we taste to each other. I began the show sharing a story about myself and a friend named Rafiq. After ignoring the lovely Indian women who we would have invited to our table if we were in America, we were content with our own company, sharing jokes and perspectives about sports, exaggerating stuff like single men do. In the middle of Rafiq telling me about a deal he was doing in Tanzania, one of the ladies came to our table and said, "Excuse me, are you guys from America?" Whenever we ask this, the initial response is always quite funny because Rafiq never really knows what to say. Because although he sounds American, his complicated history seems a bit too much to explain in a casual encounter. So I stepped in and says, "Yes, kinda. Mostly. And how are you? Where are you guys from?" They said, Durban. "We are in town on holiday to do some shopping." So, as gentlemen, nice, ordinary men in their 30s would do, we welcomed them to come over and bought them drinks. What ensued was two young Indian ladies, completely fascinated by American movies and the prospect of getting closer to a life they had experienced on TV, we ended up leaving together, played pool, and have remained friends since. Because Rafiq and I both are lighter in complexion, they both assumed we were South African coloreds before they heard us speak, and admitted to not being interested until they heard our American accents. Our taste didn't appeal to their appetites until their taste buds were wet by our history. The world operates exactly the same way. The history of an object, place, people, and product matters to how we see, experience, and taste it. The story associated with anything dictates how we digest it. I want to repeat that. Any story associated with anything will dictate how it tastes. You have what appears on the surface, and you have what appears internally, or what social critic Peter Berger terms the other reality. What's on the surface is one reality, but what Peter Berger is referring to is the other reality, the internal reality. My goal in this show, in this episode, is to show how managing the perception of the other reality, we can create an appetite for ourselves, service, business, and our brands by exploring how we position the history or the other reality, the story of the other reality. We can create an extraordinary appetite. We can whet the appetite for people wanting to engage us. In 2012, a friend was going to New York for the first time. Her goal was to land and immediately take the Sex and the City tour, and primarily to get off the tour bus and shop at the Manolo Blahnik shoe store. Beyond the obvious luxury brands such as Jimmy Choo and Manolo Blahnik blessed many a woman wear with, it's the perceived silent history of craftsmanship, mastery of the artistic endeavor, and the extraordinary creative discipline of the designer behind the brand that inspires women to walk taller while wearing these names. This is, of course, the internal reality. The external reality is the brand associations such as famous people wearing them and high-level luxury promotions, but that's not my goal. We get that external reality. If you listen to this show, you understand a lot of people spend a lot of money on positioning the brand externally, the attributes of the brand externally, the look, the aesthetic. We're not talking about that today. We're talking about the history and what that means to how people taste. My goal is to show you that it's the other reality that really determines the deep value of how the brand tastes. Paul Bloom, professor of psychology at Yale University and author of the book, How Pleasure Works. It's also a book that really changed my life, and I would recommend you get it. Argues it's this other reality, or what he terms essence, from the discipline essentialism, that really creates the extraordinary appetite for people, places, and things. Essentially, the real pleasure we get from personal relationships and organizational brands are derived from the perceived history, values, and ingredients oozing from them. Imagine you found out your favorite personal brand was accused of child trafficking, or a personal brand you revere, someone you want to be your mentor, was accused of molestation. You'd be so grossed out, and despite their potential to add value to your life, you would want to disassociate immediately. In Bloom's work, he unpacks studies that show people are willing to pay higher prices for a sweater if they knew it was worn by George Clooney, and would derive much less pleasure if the sweater was washed before they purchased it. This washing is seen to the buyer to be washing the essence or the other reality off or out of the sweater, reducing a layer of the value. On the surface, it's still a good-looking sweater. It's a nice sweater that appeals to the eye. But when the history changes, the value changes. The study has been repeated on many levels. The internal essence and value coming from the story, association, and history provides a powerful layer of value, even though it is all based on perception. Evolutionary psychologists believe we are wired this way to demonstrate status and signal to society that we are of a higher positioning, which basically helps us become more attractive in this game called life, giving us a competitive edge. Imagine if the shoes worn by Nelson Mandela when he walked out of prison went on auction. They would undoubtedly bring in millions. The brogues thrown at former U.S. President George Bush at a press conference in the Middle East were perhaps worth less than 1,000 rand before they were flung at him during a speech. But afterwards, they became a defiant symbol of anti-imperialistic power. And the same shoes were reportedly sold for around $80 million to a Saudi millionaire. It was a Saudi millionaire's ability to see the story as a defiant middle finger to the West. It aligned with his appetite for things he deeply believed in. I often overhear women doing a check. They do a check on the other reality of their girlfriend's Louis Vuitton handbag by asking, is it real or is it fake? They're acknowledging that by appearance alone and practical purposes aside, they simply can't tell the difference. They're simply doing a history and an essence check to decide if they should honor or frown on the bag's other reality. The inference being, if the bag is fake, then maybe you are fake. And if you are fake, then maybe I should distance myself from fake people because your fakeness may rub off on me. This gets quite funny, but it also is quite complicated. Consider for a moment the black women's hair weave debate that Chris Rock found so fascinating that impacted his daughter so much that he ended up doing a reality show based on it. Not a reality show, a film, a whole movie called Good Hair. Could this be the reason why that debate doesn't go away? That somehow the history of the hair and the history of the person are not aligned, which creates a bizarre contradiction in the perceived appetite, which causes confusion in the person's evolutionary wiring. I'll let you take that conversation further. That's not what this show is about. If a Zulu male wants to marry a Zulu princess, the amount of lobola he pays to her family has little to do with how much she loves him or he loves her, but is primarily premised on her perceived value. If she has royal status, education, and her other historical personal attributes, such as whether or not she is a virgin and without children. I'm interested in the fact that if a man thought he was marrying a royal woman and found out later that she was not royal, how that would impact the lobola. If somebody finds that out for me, please let me know. All categories and even racial groups receive the same associated benefit from history. In psychology, Bloom notes the term essentialism suggests that we assign deeply inherent properties to groups and categories. Examples: we believe and expect a lion will roar. A Mercedes is classy. African Americans will be loud. Eastern Cape women should be watched closely. Okay, that's a joke. Guys, that's a joke. Because they may take your man. Indians appreciate a good discount. That's a joke. You know, you're with me. And shoes are made to be worn on your feet and not on your head. This is this essentialism. And while we know there are obvious exceptions to each of these stereotypes, we use these perception barometers or shortcuts, which are known in behavioral economics as heuristics, to maneuver efficiently and manage risk, but more importantly, to ensure we enrich ourselves by eating and digesting things that will bring us pleasure, significance, and the ability to survive. I want to just say quickly that you may be thinking, dude, what does taste have to do with any of this? I believe fundamentally, just about every spiritual text in the world talks about eating spiritual essence. Even in the Bible, it says, unless you eat of my flesh and drink of my blood, you shall not have eternal life. All throughout every spiritual text, it talks about digesting spirituality. We are wired to digest. This is where cannibalism even came from. The idea that you would eat someone. You've heard me speak before about this German guy, Armin Wies, who decided to eat someone who was more articulate and more courageous, and how at the end he ended up feeling more articulate and more courageous. Now, I'm not suggesting you go out and eat someone, but I'm suggesting that you understand that internal properties are digestible. When someone cheats on you, you feel sick to the stomach. When someone lets you down and they pisses you off, or they do something, or they end up doing something that contradicts with your values, showing that their internal body is corrupt, Their values are corrupt. You often say, you make me sick. I can't stand the sight of you. That's where this comes from. That at the end of the day, when someone contradicts your values and it shows that their internal essence is nasty, it can make you sick. Your success will largely depend on how you are able to elevate your perceived taste. As individuals, our personal brands are impacted by our perceived history. And we walk into a room, our histories waltz in with us. Let's be clear. Different people will taste essence differently. For example, if an African person walks into a meeting late, an African person is leading the meeting, it's possible the leader of the meeting will digest this just fine. Although there are many Africans who despise African time, you would have a much better chance than if the person was from a white European background. The white European person will digest this late gesture as a rotten serving almost universally. How you unpack and demonstrate your history, essence, and story impacts the taste. The brain processes this essence as ingredients or a recipe with flavor, which dictates the taste. For example, as I just mentioned, if a person cheats on you while you're in a committed relationship, the values are presented as rotten and contradicts with your values, and this is experienced as nasty. I believe with deep conviction that this is perhaps one of the greatest opportunities in race relations. Many races see each other as tasting bad. Let me be blunt. Having values and a history that they simply can't digest. One person sees another's history and stories as potentially linking to their ability to use lessons and values from their history to assist in their survival versus reduce their journey. The appetite for engaging is usually heightened if this happens. If you don't take other people's history serious and don't feel like you can learn from them or find pleasure in them, you will usually reject them. I've learned to embrace that through conditioning in the media, movies, bad experiences, that most people who look like me don't on the surface to appear to have much to teach the world. And this is very personal. Let me be clear. Sure, there are thousands of people who look like me who are pioneering and valuable to advance in society. But for a moment, I want you to think of every Nobel Prize winner in literature. Think of leading CEOs at Google and tech companies. Think of astronauts. The vast majority do not look like me. There's been limited appetite developed for me on people's professional menu. Listeners to this podcast will understand how history has played a role in this. But my goal is to simply share that as the world shifts and more people who look like me are getting opportunity and beginning to show the world what we can do, me and others who look like me play a role in shifting the appetite of those in power who we hope to partner with to ensure the power is evenly spread. The people in power who don't look like me play a self-introspective role in being conscious and aware, but we know that this has been the argument for decades. So I wanted to present a different side. We can engineer a desire for each other by positioning ourselves to taste better, by helping people see the beauty in our history, by demonstrating patterns of value and excellence and a flavor in our approach that creates a taste the world will want to eat. Every major empire on one level or another has exported their history and value to inspire others to want to eat it regularly, which has ensured sustained growth, which some call imperialism. Whatever you call it, it's vital that others want to digest what you offer. Think about Italy. The entire world has Italian restaurants. People, when they taste Italian food, they think they're tasting a piece of Italy. When we can position Africa in a way where people go, I'm tasting a piece of Africa and it tastes delicious. Not just African people, but the entire world. When there's a desire to taste Africa in a beautiful way, then we create opportunities for export growth and so on and so on. As you go about scripting your personal brand goals, just know then you must contend with the group you were born into, gender, race, etc. And while developing your script, you consider your birth group, but live out your destiny knowing you have the power to make your past work for you. Let's go back to those young ladies. It's quite sad that Rafiki and I were part of a non-group until they heard our accent. But interestingly, there are people who heard our accent who hated us. There have been people who heard me speak and immediately shut down because they think America tastes nasty. So there will be some people who hear that you're a Zulu and can't wait to meet you and hear more about you. And there will be some that are turned off. There will be people, when they find out you're Afrikaans, they want to work with you. If you're Jewish, they want to work with you, and vice versa. Your job is to say, I can create an appetite in just about anybody if they really, truly understand. And I've been able to prove that in my career, which is why I have such a diverse readership, listenership from around the world, that I believe that there are things about ingredients in essence that are universal, that where I come from, who I am, what I look like, should not matter as much as what's on the inside or that other reality. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Brain and Brand Show. I'm extremely grateful, as always. You can email me, TimothyMaurice@gmail.com, or go to my website, www.timothymaurice.com. You can book me to come to your conferences, bookings@timothymaurice.com. We'll be back next week with the next episode of the Brain and Brand Show.
This is CliffCentral.com.